you know, I think what happens and what gets public companies in trouble is that managers, you know, because they are tasked with maximizing shareholder wealth, they think that they are acting to some extent in the interests of shareholders. And that to me is the more tricky problem to address. You can't just solve that by solving executive compensation.
You're listening to Bite-Sized Business Law, where we discuss big issues in small doses. This podcast is sponsored by the Fordham University School of Law Corporate Law Center, which is run by Fordham Law Professor Richard Squire and me, your host, Amy Martella. Okay, let's get down to business.
Welcome back to Bite-Sized Business Law. It seems that the very purpose of a corporation, to make money over the long run, has been dashed by incentives to perform quarter after quarter after quarter. As the American attention span diminishes while our hunger for instant gratification and constant growth intensifies, how should the law evolve? How should corporations adapt? And what's the SEC's role in reining it all in? Our guest today literally wrote the book on this topic. Jim Park is a professor at UCLA Law School and a leading expert in securities regulation, public companies, and securities fraud. His most recent book, The Valuation Treadmill, identifies a principal cause of securities fraud and analyzes the often dire consequences of unsustainable pressure that we put on public companies to perform. Jim, welcome.
Thanks so much, Amy. Thank you for having me on the podcast.
Yeah, we're so excited. I mean, this was a great book. It was recommended to me by a practitioner who is in big law here in New York City, practicing securities law. So I was so thrilled that you agreed to talk to us about it. So why don't we start out with, and by the way, I love the title, The Valuation Treadmill, because it just evokes like this imagery in your head. So what is the valuation treadmill conundrum in a nutshell?
You know, just my good luck is that there's an article today in the Wall Street Journal that Lyft announced its earnings and there's a typo where their profit margin should have been reported at 50, but they reported it at 500. And for a while after hours, the stock price went up by 60%. And I think this is a really timely example of how markets focus on quarterly reporting and quarterly results. If you are a public corporation, you have to run very hard just to stay in the same place. And that's sort of where the analogy of the treadmill comes in. And I thought it was just sort of a nice phrase to capture what public corporations go through. And this is really what distinguishes public companies from private companies. You have to deliver consistent results or your valuation is going to fall. And, you know, this creates a lot of pressure on public companies. And you know, some of them cheat. And I think that's where we need strong laws against securities fraud. And, you know, this is a history of securities fraud and its regulation. And I thought this was a nice way of tying together the evolution of the problem and the law over different decades.
I really enjoyed this because so a while back we interviewed Diana Henriquez, who wrote a book called Taming the Street. And she is not a lawyer, but she's an investigative journalist. And it's all about the, you know, the inception of the SEC and the Great Depression and all of that. So that piece of history in FDR and Joe Kennedy is so interesting. Now, your book kind of picks up on that in the 50s and walks us all the way through to modern day. So I kind of love to thread that together.
Yeah, I mean, it does start sort of around the 50s and 60s. That was a time when securities fraud was not really seen as a big problem for major public corporations. It was viewed as something that startup companies might do when they're doing an IPO, less reputable companies that were not listed on stock exchanges. And, you know, I think there's good reason for that, right? In the 50s and 60s, you have these US corporate giants that are dominant. They're dominant in their industry. They don't really need to commit fraud. The organizations are getting so large that you need professional managers. Managerialism and the study of management becomes a science, and investors are fairly passive. They sort of trust corporate managers to make decisions, and they're not really pressuring them as much. And they didn't need to be pressured because the profits were fairly regular and plentiful without international competition. And so that's sort of where we start in the story. And, you know, part of the story is that that changes, that begins to change probably around the 1960s or so, 1970s for a variety of reasons. And I think one is the rise of institutional investors. You know, you have more sophisticated investors that are buying larger stakes in companies, and they want to be informed, right? They want to be informed about their investments more so than the average retail investor. And so this gives rise to research analysts. Research analysts don't really show up in force until sometime around the 1960s. And, you know, what do research analysts do is they make forecasts, right? They make projections about future performance, because that's how you value any asset like a public corporation. And so they're issuing these forecasts. And, you know, part of what would be helpful to them are the internal projections that corporate managers have come up with to manage their businesses. As you have a larger business, you need forecasts to help you allocate resources within the company. And so the analysts are getting those forecasts. They're getting those forecasts that's making their forecasts more reliable. And sort of the irony of the story is that this sort of reliance upon the expertise of managers kind of evolves to become a test of them. It becomes a test that if they are not releasing accurate forecasts, if they're not meeting them, then their stock price will go down.
So there's a real utility to forecasting, but there's also kind of a dark side, it sounds like.
It is. I mean, it's essential to any large organization, right? You need to figure out, you know, how the different units are performing. You need to allocate resources. You need to know how much money you need to raise. And, you know, it comes up all the time. You know, the recent decision by Chancellor McCormick in the Elon Musk compensation case talks a bit about the company's projections. And one of the points that the opinion makes is that, you know, they kind of knew that the benchmarks would be exceeded, that 70% of the benchmarks would be exceeded. And so there's, you know, there's one view that, look, these projections, you can't accurately project the future. And there was always skepticism about that in the 50s and 60s, and even now. But this is a nice example very recently where a very informed, smart Delaware judge says that they had very reliable projections that indicated the threshold would be met. And that's part of the reason why the pay package was not fair.
So you say something that I thought was worth noting in the book, because it kind of cuts against this Friedman-esque theory of the purpose of a corporation. You say, securities fraud is the natural result of a world where public companies have been pushed to prioritize the maximization of shareholder wealth. And you also mentioned that valuation models that came about with the inception of analysts and forecasting are what separate stock markets from casinos. So can you walk us through, give us a quick few minutes about these case studies that you pepper in, which are so informative, starting maybe with Xerox, because I don't know if people remember that Xerox was a big scandal.
It was. And it was the first time the Securities and Exchange Commission levied a substantial penalty against a corporate entity, a public corporation, for securities fraud, a $10 million penalty. And that was seen as a significant event. That's not a big penalty these days, but that was the start. That was sort of the start of the SEC penalizing corporations.
So tell our listeners what Xerox did wrong in their eyes.
You know, this was the 1990s. And so Xerox, as you know, was the inventor of the copy machine, the plain copy machine. Before you had Xerox, you had to use a special chemical paper in order to make copies. They figured out technology that would allow us to just put paper into the machine and that would create copies. And, you know, through the 1960s, 70s, they grew tremendously. They start to see some foreign competition in the 70s and 80s. They beat that back. And part of the way they do that is by emphasizing efficiency and strong management decisions. By the 1990s, the pressure to meet projections has grown. And, you know, the projection kind of shows up somewhere in the 1960s or so, but it's more on an annual basis. And with technology and more sophisticated financial markets, we begin having more of a quarterly system during the 1980s and 1990s. So Xerox is in a position where it has to meet quarterly numbers. What's happening in the 1990s? This is the rise of the internet. And if you can email your colleague a PDF of a document, you don't need to make copies of it anymore. So Xerox is facing a lot of competition. It's telling this story, though, that it's still thriving, even in the internet era. You know, the CEO does an interview with the Wall Street Journal. It's on the front page. And one of the things that the CEO says is, look at our double-digit revenue growth. That shows you that we are still adapting and relevant in this internet age. The truth of the matter, though, is that the only reason that they were able to show this sort of growth is that they were moving billions of dollars of revenue forward, recognizing it in earlier periods. And I won't get into the technical details of the accounting violation itself, but a lot of the revenue is through these long-term leases. And generally, you know, parts of the revenue have to be recognized over time. Parts of it can be recognized earlier. And they arbitrarily changed some key assumptions in order to recognize a lot of the revenue much earlier in violation of generally accepted accounting principles. So what was the effect of this? Well, it meant that for 2 or 3 years, they were always meeting their quarterly projections. According to the SEC, if they had not done this, they would have reported flat revenue, flat profits. They could not have told the story that they did. And, you know, once this comes out, the company really loses its credibility. And, you know, I don't think it's ever completely recovered. It's never completely recovered from that particular scandal. And, you know, Xerox is one of dozens of cases during the late 90s where you see this problem of companies violating GAAP in order to meet earnings projections.
Okay, so that's your kind of classic manipulating the accounting practices to meet projections because your business is in decline. You don't want to admit it. You don't want your investors to realize it because the valuation will fall. You also write about an interesting case, Penn Central. That kind of demonstrates a different side of the pressure of valuation. This is a corporate governance conglomerate case study. So tell us a little bit about that one. It's super interesting.
It's very interesting. And a lot of scholars know Penn Central as, you know, arguably one of the first really big corporate governance scandals for a large, major corporation in the 1970s. And Penn Central is often cited as the point where we lost faith in managers, right? The 50s and 60s, we trusted managers. That's the era of managerialism. Penn Central is sort of this symbolic event where your company, largest railroad in the country, suddenly files for bankruptcy. Where were the managers? Where was the board? What's not as appreciated is that it's also a securities fraud story in part. Penn Central was in a declining business, the railroad business. And, you know, by the 60s or so, you've got the interstate highway. You've got
air travel.
Yeah, cheaper air travel. You just don't need trains as much. And so you have these very proud companies, the Pennsylvania and the New York, blue chip companies for a long time, what we would call widows and orphan stock, where, you know, you can just rely upon the dividends from these investments. They're just not able to compete. And so they merge. They enter into a merger and form the Penn Central. And it's imperative for them to show the merger's working, that they're able to turn around their core business and achieve profitability because the thought is, we merge, we're going to cut costs, we're going to achieve synergies. And so the CEO adopts essentially a shareholder wealth maximization policy to get to our earlier point about shareholder wealth maximization and says, we got to do everything we can to maximize shareholder wealth. And that's sort of new, right? That's sort of new around that time, because in the 50s and 60s, corporate managers thought of themselves as weighing the interests of a wide variety of stakeholders. And so what do? They sell a bunch of assets to generate revenue. Nothing wrong with that. You can generate revenue by selling assets. But, you know, there are a handful of transactions that were questionable. One of them involved the sale of a Six Flags amusement park to a partnership of investors for, I think it was about $30 million. And, you know, the sale was problematic because there was a side letter between Penn Central and the investors, which said that Penn Central would basically absorb any losses if the value of the Six Flags amusement park fell. In order to really sell an asset, you've got to transfer the risk of loss. And that was not done. So Penn Central should not have recognized that $30 million. So this became a highly public sort of a dispute because a prominent accounting professor, Abe Briloff, who taught in New York City at Baruch and wrote a number of great books I'd recommend to anyone looking at the history of accounting fraud, you know, he highlighted this transaction in Barron's. The auditors were upset at his article, and they didn't actually defend the transaction on the merits. What they said was it was not material. right? And that's an important concept in securities regulation and securities fraud, is that there's only liability for a material misrepresentation. Their argument is $30 million. It's not going to fundamentally change investor perception of Penn Central. Briloff, though, had a very telling response. And he said, look, the reason why Penn Central did this was that they had predicted a favorable showing in their annual results. And without this $30 million, they would have had to report a loss instead of a small profit. And he has this little headline in the article, Meeting the Projection. And he says that it is material because without it, their results would have looked worse than without it. And I think this is just a very interesting development where we're thinking about materiality a little bit differently as markets are changing. Penn Central involved a lot of other examples of bad governance. And in some ways, there's a lot of remarkable similarities between Penn Central and Enron and the board of directors. There was self-dealing by the chief financial officer, just as we had with Andy Fasto at Enron. I mean, so there was a lot of criticism of the board. How could you be asleep at the switch and not know that the company was in such dire straits? And so it's a very significant, interesting case, and also a key marker in our understanding of the concept of materiality.
So let me ask you this, Jim. So the SEC fined both Xerox and Penn Central. Did individual stockholders sue the companies?
Yes, that's right. Penn Central was sued and they paid a fairly substantial settlement along with auditors. So there were a number of different defendants, and actually maybe most of the settlement may have come from auditors and so forth. I don't remember the details, but there was a securities class action that was filed against Penn Central for earnings fraud. And in Xerox as well, there was a class action against Xerox that recovered a very substantial amount. So that, in effect, maybe supplemented the $10 million penalty that the SEC imposed in that case.
Okay. All right. Interesting. So we've spoken so far about inflating numbers to meet future projections. I wanted to talk to you about kind of the next step in this story, which was in the mid-90s, early 90s, as you mentioned, the era of the internet, Apple came along and they're kind of hyping a product that doesn't end up living up to expectations. That's kind of another flavor of all this. So talk to us about what happened there with Apple, which we now all revere and think their products are amazing. But back then, they had some issues.
Yeah, back then, they were still a newly public company. And they had rocketed to tremendous success with the Apple II, which was one of the first really popular personal computers. And, you know, they go from a garage to a $2 billion public company in just a few years. And just remarkable story. But, you know, they have to show they're not a one-hit wonder. And they have to keep producing. And so they were developing this office computer called the Lisa. And the idea was that the office market is bigger. As we know, that's how IBM becomes fairly dominant in the 1980s and 1990s. And this was their attempt to do this. And, you know, one of the sort of highlights was a disk drive called the Twiggy, which is a high-performance disk drive. This is the days before we had cloud computing, huge hard drives. You had to load up everything onto a floppy drive. And so, you know, during the 80s and 90s, this is sort of the time when investors begin, I think, valuing companies more based on their future performance, and tech companies especially, where you might have a product that is extremely, extremely transformative and successful and profitable, you know it's coming down the road, investors are willing to pay for those earnings now and bid up the stock price. The volatility, though, that results from a situation like that is that, you know, the prospects of the product will fluctuate. And if you announce that we're delaying the release of this product or there's glitches in it, investors will get scared and all of that future earnings that are baked into the price can quickly dissipate and the stock price goes down. So there's pressure on these companies to essentially delay bad news, emphasize the good news. Apple does this. They issue press releases saying essentially that the Twiggy is done. It's high performance. They say it's been tested extensively, implying it is done and it works. In fact, there are a ton of glitches with the product, so bad that they have to discontinue it, and the stock price goes down by 25% when that is announced.
Wow.
Yeah, and so it's a case then where the plaintiffs, they basically make the argument that you know, you should have told us that there was a problem earlier so that we wouldn't have bought the stock at this inflated price. Now, the defendants have a pretty good argument, I think. And their argument is, look, this is just how product development works. With a complex product, you just don't know until the very end whether it's actually going to work and be successful. And, you know, I think that, you know, it's something that we see in technology that, you know, products fail. And you should know this as an investor. If you make us liable here, you're taxing entrepreneurship, you're going to reduce risk taking, and that's bad for the economy. The jury agrees, actually, though, with the plaintiffs and awards them $100 million in a verdict, which sends shockwaves through Silicon Valley. And this is what results, I think, in momentum for the technology Silicon Valley industry to push for a law called the PSLRA, the Private Securities Litigation Reform Act.
Okay. So yeah. So Apple is found liable for what, you know, Jack Coffey calls general expressions of optimism about their product. And the point you're making is like, this is how it's done in the tech space. This is what everyone is doing in Silicon Valley. You're developing something. It has issues, setbacks. You know, you just kind of hope that by the release date, everything has been ironed out. So talk to us about this moment where the Private Securities Litigation Reform Act, the PSLRA, any securities lawyer knows it as a turning point. Talk to us a little bit about that and the safe harbors that it gives to companies like Apple.
Yeah, it's a very significant law passed in 1995, and it makes it more difficult to file securities class actions. It increases procedural barriers such as pleading. And importantly, it contains a safe harbor for forward-looking statements, projections. And the safe harbor says if you have meaningful cautionary statements that accompany the forward-looking statement, and also if you can show alternatively you didn't know the projection was wrong, that you cannot be liable for a material misrepresentation class action brought by a private plaintiff. It highlights sort of the importance of projections, right? We see them emerging in the 50s and 60s. By mid-1995, we have a specific safe harbor that is directed at projections and making sure that companies can issue them. Because, you know, the SEC also supported, to some extent, the safe harbor. And their rationale is that they actually want companies to issue projections and issue them broadly and more generally and disseminate them. If we have too much liability for projections, then they'll be too scared to issue them. And so the SEC is beginning to recognize this is how companies are valued. And we need some reasonable rules to protect companies from frivolous securities litigation. That's sort of the idea behind the PSLRA.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense that both the SEC and public companies were excited by the passage of the PSLRA. Now, was this measure successful? And if so, was it successful in the beginning? Do we still find that it's successful?
I would say yes and no. It was successful in the sense that it reduced the filing of completely meritorious securities class actions where the only allegation is that, hey, you didn't meet your projection and the stock price went down. It really shifted plaintiffs' attorneys to focusing in on more hard indicia of securities fraud, as Professor Stephen Choi at NYU has referred to them in a number of path-breaking studies that have established this particular fact. He and Adam Pritchard have done really great work, empirical work in this space. So it has worked in that sense, to the extent that it has reduced the cost and threat of securities class actions, been less successful. And there's debate as to why that's the case. My view is that, you know, the reason it has not reduced huge settlements of securities class actions is that the late 90s, early 2000s, we just saw a wave of significant securities frauds involving, you know, companies like Enron and WorldCom. And that's essentially what I think saved the securities class action and legitimized it, because I think there was a fair amount of consensus that there was, you know, real fraud at these companies, as opposed to, you know, there's an argument that, you know, maybe Apple is not really a fraud. And that, you know, I don't totally agree with that, but I think that there is a stronger argument there with respect to some of those qualitative misstatements. And with these big accounting fraud cases with restatements, acknowledgements that there are errors, I think that saved the securities class action. And it still leaves the problem that, you know, companies pay a lot to settle these cases. And it can be quite expensive to defend securities class actions even today.
So you're saying, Jim, that the PSLRA was effective in kind of weeding out completely non-meritorious cases, but it still left, of course, as we want it to, left open the possibility of getting these companies on actual fraud.
That's right.
Okay, so that brings us up to how Sarbanes-Oxley came about. And you mentioned Enron, you mentioned WorldCom. Those were real self-dealing and, you know, but I felt like with Enron, we're kind of back to that future performance litigation. Is that right?
Absolutely. It's very much a case about projections. Part of the case is about moving liabilities off your balance sheet to make your credit rating look better. But, you know, if you look especially at the criminal prosecution, what they emphasize is meeting projections and using accounting mechanisms to do that. So it is very much in the vein of cases like Xerox. And, you know, one of the things I think that not a lot of people appreciate about Sarbanes-Oxley is that the perception is, oh, it's just this reaction to Enron and WorldCom. And certainly Enron and WorldCom were the proximate causes of that statute being passed. But my view is that there were two major waves of securities frauds around that time, right? One is sort of the late 1990s incidents, Waste Management, Cendant, Xerox to some extent. And that actually led the SEC to focus in on this problem of the valuation treadmill and accounting violations to meet projections. And there were a number of reforms that the exchanges, the stock exchanges, and the SEC had put into place before Enron and WorldCom to address this issue. There is a perception that it's working. At least that's what Arthur Levitt, the SEC chair, and various other SEC officials are saying in speeches, kind of embarrassingly, maybe just a year or so before Enron and WorldCom. So I think what happens then is you have this second wave of securities frauds that has happened despite these reforms. And so what else is left to do is you have to pass a statute.
Right. So
I think that's what happened.
Okay. So you don't agree with the criticisms of Sarbanes-Oxley that it was passed too hastily, or that it shouldn't have targeted all public companies, or that it was just reactionary and all of those criticisms?
There is some validity to the hastiness point. I do think that, you know, Professor Roberta Romano, who I think is the leading scholar on this point, has a good point that, you know, many aspects of the law are not supported by empirical academic evidence. And I think, you know, it was passed in a frenzy, and certainly, you know, that might have led to an overbroadness to the law. Now, a lot of that, though, gets worked out over time with some smaller companies being exempt from some of the requirements. And Dodd-Frank puts that into a statute as well. And at this, you know, I think there is an argument that maybe it still imposes too many burdens on public companies and makes them pressured to grow larger. On the other hand, my book is an argument as to why Sarbanes-Oxley should generally apply to public corporations. You know, if you believe this valuation pressure is common to public companies, then the answer to that is some sort of structural response, some sort of structural expectation that if you are a public corporation, you have strong enough internal controls in order to provide reasonable assurance that your financial reporting is accurate. That's what divides public companies and private companies. Now, could we parse this a little bit more and say that, you know, do we want to lump all of, you know, so many companies into the public company category? Sure, you can make arguments like that. But, you know, the position I have taken in my book is that, you know, this is a structural issue that requires a structural solution, and that's what justifies Sarbanes-Oxley generally.
Right. Okay, so where does Dodd-Frank fit into the valuation pressure? I know that, you know, in this scenario, it was more about, you know, the banks misrepresented their exposure to subprime mortgages, but there was a lot of, and you pointed out in your book, as many scholars have, no one went to jail, people were upset about it. There seemed to be a lot more mystifying information in the subprime crisis, like where the actual CEOs and managers themselves were like, I was just as surprised as the investors.
It's a tough question, and I don't have a good answer to it. But, you know, my view is that the crisis in 2008, 2009 was somewhat different than what we saw with Enron and WorldCom. And, you know, there were misrepresentations, misleading statements made about subprime exposure. Citigroup is penalized significantly in a settlement with the SEC, you know, when it essentially issues misleading information about a subprime exposure. But the bulk of the losses, though, I think you could argue were part of this, you know, 100-year flood where markets just are, you know, going crazy. And, you know, just the extent of that crisis could not have been totally predicted by the CEOs, and that to some extent they were surprised with how bad things got themselves, and that they, for the most part, were, you know, not enriching themselves. I think that's another piece of the puzzle. You know, do we have a lot of examples of CEOs selling off a bunch of stock before, you know, the crisis actually happens? I don't think so. You know, in Enron and WorldCom, that is a key part of both of those stories, rightly or wrongly. Certainly Bernie Ebbers, who's, you know, pressuring his CFO, you know, meet the numbers. I don't care how you do it, which leads to billions of dollars of sort of expenses moved off the income statement to the balance sheet. That may have been motivated by the fact he's taking out loans against his WorldCom stock. So, you know, Dodd-Frank tries to address that through executive compensation, additional reforms about executive compensation, disclosures about executive compensation, say on pay votes. That's, I think, their contribution to the extent executive compensation is a contributor to the problem of accounting fraud and other types of securities fraud.
And just explain that for our listeners. Why is executive compensation puts pressure on the CEO to do what?
They, you know, have a personal financial incentive to keep the stock price high. And this is something that happens more over the 1990s. Executives are paid more in equity compensation, stock options, and stock. And the what we call an agency cost story, which is a fairly simple, well-accepted explanation for why managers do what they do, is that their personal interest is to meet these projections, keep the stock price high so that they can sell off their stock at an inflated price. And certainly there are cases like that. There are certainly cases where we see conduct that is consistent with executive compensation being the motivation for misleading information and accounting fraud. I don't think it's a complete explanation, though, of why public companies commit securities fraud. And that's also another point of the book, is that you also see cases where you have corporate managers who, you know, they're not selling a lot of their stock. You know, I think going back to the CEO of Penn Central, one of the things the SEC report notes is that the CEO doesn't sell any of his stock during the period of misstatements. Now, some other executives do sell a lot of their stock, but the CEO is a believer. And I think, you know, I think what happens and what gets public companies in trouble is that managers, you know, because they are tasked with maximizing shareholder wealth, they think that they are acting to some extent in the interests of shareholders. And that to me is the more tricky problem to address. You can't just solve that by solving executive compensation.
Right. Well, now I want to ask you, they're also now trying to solve it through another method. And that's a method you describe at the end of the book called real earnings management, where they've realized we can't manipulate the numbers. We obviously have to abide by generally accepted accounting principles. But maybe we can do other things like cut research and development or move assets around. What's wrong with that?
It's a very complicated question. And, you know, the courts have generally and often dismissed these types of cases. The reason why they say it's not a securities fraud is that there is not necessarily misleading information that has been issued. Like if I have cooked the books and inflated my earnings number, I have issued a material misrepresentation. If I'm making business decisions and using that to meet projections, there may not be a statement that is issued to investors. If I violate GAAP, generally accepted accounting principles, that's a misrepresentation because every public corporation commits to complying with GAAP. It's a little bit more tricky when we are using real earnings management. And the SEC, though, in a number of cases has taken the position that it is materially misleading. And that's a very interesting divergence. And part of the reason I think we're seeing some of these cases is that we're not seeing as many blatant GAAP violations as we did, you know, 15, 20 years ago. And that might be a testament to the success of Sarbanes-Oxley and its reforms, We're seeing fewer restatements by public corporations. And to the extent that you have fewer of those clear gap violation cases, I think the SEC is making a point that, well, there are these other practices that can also be misleading.
Yeah, and I think it speaks to your entire thesis is like, yes, they're no longer violating gap and they're not issuing these restatements, but this pressure still exists. And where there is pressure, they will find a way to meet these expectations. So, I mean, maybe these laws have been affected to an extent, but that they didn't really reduce the pressure.
That's right. That's right.
So when do you think these companies will learn that, like, you can only hide the body for so long? Eventually, these practices do catch up to them, and sometimes they lose credibility.
That's the danger, right, of these practices, is that if you delay reporting losses, then you may eventually have to recognize that, and it's a bigger loss that surprises the marketplace. The hope, I think, of the managers is that if we keep delaying it, you know, we're going to get lucky and things will turn around. Or maybe they sincerely believe performance will turn around. We're never going to have to acknowledge that we had these losses. And, you know, you could say the General Electric case that the SEC brought fits that description, where in 2017, they report massive losses in healthcare and energy. Their stock price goes down by like 70-80%, right? More was lost by investors in that decline than Enron and WorldCom combined. They were using real earnings management to meet various types of projections. And I think that their hope was that they could manage their way out of the problem. At some point, it becomes too big to ignore. And that's why the SEC brings a case and sanctions them for $200 million. And, you know, a key point, I think, in that case is that their allegations that they knew these earnings management techniques were not sustainable. And I think that's the key thing that might distinguish, you know, the type of earnings management that violates the law and the types of decisions that are made every day by public corporations is that, you know, when you know this is misleading investors, it's not sustainable. When you get to that point, it can become misleading, according to the SEC.
So, Jim, what are your suggestions for how we get off of this treadmill?
I'm not sure we can, because for all of the problems with projections and quarterly reports, this may be the best system that we have, because, you know, this does provide incentives to work hard for managers. And that was a concern during the 1970s, that managers were just phoning it in, you know, playing a lot of golf. They didn't have any incentive to increase shareholder value, increase efficiency. Quarterly reports do provide some pressure in terms of disciplining managers. The hope, I think, is though, is that we find, you know, better metrics, a more long-term qualitative information. And to me, that's part of what the ESG disclosure movement is about, is kind of finding ways of assessing long-term value through disclosure, rather than just having a system where you just skip to the, you know, the income statement and look at the whether or not the revenue and earnings are going to meet quarterly projections. I think there needs to be more transparency about how projections are made. And I think that information about projections in some ways could be very useful to investors, particularly retail investors who might be puzzled that, you know, why is this company reporting, you know, losses, but they have a high stock market valuation? And it's because there are projections, sophisticated projections about growth into the future. You know, how are these projections made? What is the basis for these types of projections? And I think something like that would be something that the SEC should think about and explore, you know, ways of finding better ways to disclose information that will make this process of setting and meeting projections more transparent, particularly for ordinary investors.
You also mentioned, Jim, that courts might want to consider the idea that proving a motive to meet a projection in and of itself is sufficient to establish that a company acted with fraudulent intent. I find that's a little controversial. What tell us about that.
That is controversial. And I think that, you know, courts in 10b-5 litigation could do a number of things, I think, to make that area of law a little bit more consistent and comprehensible. And, you know, I think one of the realities is that the typical Sientra story of let's find a bunch of stock sales, insider trading sales, and say that provides the motive. That's not really the theory of securities fraud that is most prevalent now. And I think that if you have, you know, particularized evidence that, you know, this is a company that was obsessed with meeting projections, it was very important to them, that this particular metric was sufficiently important at the time the misstatement was made, that that certainly could support a finding of scienter or fraudulent intent. And I suspect that courts are already sort of looking at that in assessing recklessness. And that's kind of the way you establish scienter these days, more so than our typical motive and opportunity test that the Second Circuit set forth a while ago. And I think that reflects more of the new realities of how securities frauds happen. Another thought I would have is I think the duty to disclose is going to be stronger and maybe should be stronger with respect to 10b-5. And I think the SEC is already moving in the direction of having somewhat stronger duties to disclose when you know, for example, that you know certain projections are not feasible, that there are certain risks involved that are going to affect you in the future. And I think that you know that's the other evolution that we're seeing with the SEC at least. And to some extent, maybe we'll see that in private litigation as well as ESG matters become more important. And that is an important part of future performance, future risk. And I think that, you know, the courts are trying to figure out how to deal with those types of cases right now.
Absolutely. It'll be interesting to see how ESG tightens the regulations in this area. Well, Jim, thank you so much for joining us today for your incredibly insightful and interesting book, The Valuation Treadmill, which everyone should go pick up. This was such a joy speaking with you, and thanks again for joining us.
Thanks so much, Amy, for having me on the podcast.
Take care.
Thanks to everyone at Fordham Law School, especially the Dean's Office and our Corporate Law Center donors for supporting this podcast. Bite-Sized Business Law is produced by We Edit Podcasts. Listen and subscribe to Bite-Sized Business Law on Spotify, Apple, or wherever you get your podcasts. The information in this podcast is for educational, informational, and entertainment purposes only and does not constitute legal advice, nor is it intended to promote the organizations with which our guests are affiliated. For more information, check out our show notes, and thanks for listening.